I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum to conduct business. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Monday, April 23rd, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just if folks could mute their cell phones. And today, we have before us HB 331, which is Tax Credit Certificate, Bond Corporation, and Royalties by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. And at this meeting, we'll first hear from Commissioner Fisher and then move to invited testimony. And if we have time, we'll go through the sectional. So with that, Commissioner Fisher, if you could put yourself on the record, and just wanted to give you the opportunity to say anything if you would like.
Well, thank you. I'm Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and I appreciate the chance to be here. I was listening and on Saturday when you all were here for 4 hours, and it's not lost on me that you were here, and I was not, and I again want to reiterate what I said then, which is I appreciate the service and the focus and the attention on this bill, as well as the many other matters that you're working on. I do believe that this bill is a good and prudent policy for the state of Alaska, that it makes sense, that it is designed to balance a number of different interests. I don't want to necessarily replow the ground that was discussed, that I felt like was a very fruitful and productive discussion on Saturday, but I did want to make myself available if there were specific questions or issues or concerns that were directed at me. I wanted to be available to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Does the committee have any questions, Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there was a little discussion about those companies who decided not to take part of this, and that we would somehow need to even something up, which I'm not sure what that something is, but would we change anything based on the company just deciding to wait their turn, and if so, why would we?
So through the chair, the way the bill is structured is it is intended to give companies the option to participate or not to participate. And so we have been working hard to try to communicate with the companies to understand what their intention is, because one of the value blocks that we have presented to you is the fact that you don't have to appropriate the full $184 million. You can appropriate something less. And what we presented to you assumes that everyone participates. And under that scenario, you would need to appropriate the interest, which would be $27 million. Let's assume that someone chooses not to participate, and they would have been entitled under the normal course to get, I'm just making something up, a $5 million payment during that year. Then we would like to understand that so we can come to you. That would, the interest payment would decline slightly because that company would not be part of the whole bonding, but there may be some additional funding that would be necessary to care for that company's interest. So we're just, our goal is to be able to understand and inform the legislature what we anticipate is really going to happen as this rolls out, should it be enacted, as it would roll out to the different credit holders. I think, as was said on Saturday, we have had multiple communications with the companies over the last number of months. So far, no one has informed us that they do not intend to participate. They've either informed us that they want to participate, which is far and away the majority. There's a handful of companies that have said they're still thinking about it and want to get back to us.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
And I'm just going to put my concern on the record. If someone chooses to wait, which is their ability to be able to do that, I want to make sure that they're not having to discount how much they're having to, or we're going to choose a lower formula so they'll have to wait longer. And that was kind of insinuated. I don't know whether it was meant to be or not, but I don't think you should be penalized just because maybe you're able to because you have enough money to be able to wait, but I just don't want to see any negative effect for that group of people.
Through the chair, I think that has been our intention, was that companies would neither be advantaged nor penalized by choosing not to participate in this.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Ortiz and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, on Saturday I called in a question, and I believe it was handled by Mr. Mitchell, Devin Mitchell. And the question was around whether or not, if we were to go down this path of engaging in this credit bond bill, whether or not that would have a potential impact on the bonding capacity for the state. For my concern is in the area of infrastructure and deferred maintenance and those kinds of things, because those are very real concerns that I think the state needs to be able to address and have a plan for addressing. He indicated that that it potentially could. Can you elaborate any more on that in terms of, you know, if we were to go down this path, what kind of an impact would that have on our on the state's ability to bond for infrastructure package?
So here's what I understand, and I don't see Mr. Mitchell in the audience, but we will bring him over if this answer is not sufficient to make sure that we get the proper response. As a general matter, I think it's our view and our understanding that this will not have a substantial impact on the state's capacity to bond. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, this debt is already on our financial statements, and so we're in many respects this can be viewed as a refinancing where we're taking an existing obligation and refinancing it in a different way. Secondly, you saw in the presentation that was given on Saturday this schedule, which showed that the overall the cumulative amount of money that was being of general funds that was being used to finance other debt, the pension obligation payments, and this debt actually kind of flattens out. So it rather than having a peaking at over 30% of UGF, which is what the current plan would do, it kind of stabilizes at about 24%, 25%, although it continues at that rate for a longer period of time. But we think that that generally actually opens up some capacity because there's more available UGF. I do think that, and then finally, I think that there's a view that the credit rating agencies view this as an interesting and helpful tool in the toolbox for the state to use in a way of managing this obligation. My understanding is that any negative impact would be very small or very modest given those considerations. I don't have a figure for you, but we can see if we can quantify that if you would like a more precise number.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. The question I have, which was brought up, I think a lot of the questions were brought up yesterday and we'll continue asking questions on them, was somebody comes in and gets the high discount rate because they're committed to reinvesting in Alaska. But we're giving them money to pay off loans or outstanding debts that they already have. And then the commitment to reinvest and keep doing work in Alaska. In the sense that they do that, they get the money and they leave, right? I'm not trying to be impolite, but their debt and what's been holding them anchored to Alaska is being paid off that debt. And maybe they put in a business an exploration or development plan that's in place, and that was part of the arrangement. And somebody buys their product, their field, their exploratory work, all the assets that they had. What continues that commitment to that plan, as much as there can be a commitment to a specific plan, rolls forward into the purchaser of that company's obligation? Now, the company has its assets have gone up because its debt has gone way down. It sells its assets off. And it rolls the business plan to the purchaser of their whatever business model they have and their assets. How do we roll that forward into the next to the next holder of that property, that product?
So through the chair, let me respond, and you can redirect if I don't hit it. I think I heard two questions in yours. The first is, if the company is using the funds these funds that they receive through this program, if they use that to pay off debt, then where is the source of capital coming from that they're going to reinvest in Alaska? And I hope that there will be some of the banks that will be testifying today. But one of the things that a number of people, both financial institutions as well as credit holders, have articulated to us is that when they have a debt that is in default, it's very difficult and very expensive for them to attract additional capital. That default has to be disclosed, and their balance sheet, in essence, has a cloud over it associated with that defaulted instrument. And so by virtue of receiving this debt, and you're absolutely correct, or rather receiving this money for this credit, you're correct that much of this money will go to pay off existing debt holders. But the fact that they are able to clean up their balance sheet and resolve that outstanding liability and the default that exists on their balance sheet, we have satisfied ourselves that that will allow them to attract capital from a number of sources. And in fact, a number of credit holders have come to us and said they already have, if this can get resolved, they have a set of investors that are prepared to invest and are enthusiastic about being able to kind of continue the projects. So I feel comfortable with that. Your second question then, I think, goes to this issue of if someone sets forth a plan, and I think on Saturday we said that DNR would review those plans. That's actually was a misstatement. DOR has the statutory direction, at least under the plan, under the bill as currently drafted. We would review those plans. And what we would be looking for is both a schedule of investments and how they intend to use the money, as well as assurances that they have that capital, that they have sources for that capital to support their plan. And then the question arises, what happens if they don't? So that they present the plan, we review it, we approve it, they get the lower discount rate. And I think it was a worthwhile observation that there should be some form of consequence, and we're currently working both internally and with the Department of Law, as well as some of the committee, some of your staff, to come up with a solution. I think the thought that we're kind of moving towards is something where they would repay the benefit. So let's say, I'm just making up numbers, let's say that it's a 90% payment under the lower discount rate let's use real dollars, a $90 million payment versus an $85 million payment, so it was $5 million of benefit, then we would have them repay that benefit plus some additional amount in the form of penalty that induces them to, motivates them to make sure they continue to keep that commitment that they've made in terms of the commitment to reinvest. Now, that generally those obligations would continue to run with the business if they sell that business, and this will be a matter of the way they sell the business, but as a general matter, those obligations would continue to run with that business if they should sell it to someone else.
If I may follow up?
Follow up.
So I assume the inference is that the plan goes with the leases or whatever it is they have. But my next question is, and thank you for clarifying that, because I don't have to put DNR in the middle of us. So you're going to review the development plans. And my question is, being here for many years, as often as not, it seems like what becomes a qualified expenditure is a question of a definition in the federal tax code in the state. But sometimes those are qualified expenditures meets the need of the doesn't meet the need of the state. They have a business plan and it meets their business plan. But the state's purpose is to get to development and production. So how do you differentiate between those two? How does somebody come in, and you're not DNR, But if you're going to be reviewing the plans, how do you determine, even though this is a qualified expenditure under the tax code, it doesn't meet the state's higher purpose of getting to production sooner than later?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I feel like I'll need to come back and give some thought to that. As a general matter, I have been assuming and that our interests are aligned. In other words, that their interest is to get to production just like our interest is. That's where they can become profitable. And so I would like to examine those scenarios where our interests may diverge and to think about how we respond.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Kawasaki, then Gren and Seaton. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I just had a couple questions about just the structure of the bill. For instance, how does the bond corporation itself work as an instrumentality of government?
So, if I may ask, I believe that there will be a sectional analysis that will be later today. And through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, would you be comfortable if we deferred that question until that point?
If we're going to hear that, then I'll wait and defer questions to that point then.
That would be great. Thank you.
Representative Grimm.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner, I'm just trying to, from my notes, kind of get this straight. And I know that we're going to be hearing invited testimony and then public testimony, but it seems to me so far we have on regarding 331 that the administration is in favor of this. Industry seems to be in favor of this. Those who are owed, those who aren't owed, other service industries connected to oil and gas, banks. Again, we're going to hear from them. Division of your division, tax division, DNR seems. You know, this is kind of lining up a lot of support that doesn't seem to naturally come when we're talking oil and gas issues. So this bill was drafted and introduced in early February, and we're in late April now. I'm just kind of wondering, you know, from your guys' journey from the administration, if you could talk about how that support has kind of, how your work on all the other different stakeholders, you know, your connection and how you've worked that, how that's come possible that this long list of supporters is coming together on something like this.
Through the chair, so thank you. When we developed this, and this was developed candidly at the request of the governor, he came to the department and said, can we find a way to deal with the tax credits and address them? And I think that his concern was primarily to help put Alaskans back to work and an opportunity that I think he felt like if we could address this issue, it would help these companies to continue with their work, which was, I think, good for Alaskans and good for the economy and the state overall. And so we developed kind of the outline of the strategy and the structure and went through a few different scenarios trying to kind of develop something that we thought was workable. And then we also then started to sit down with different participants that we thought would have different views. So virtually everyone on that list, we kind of reached out to them to try to get their input and their thoughts. And what's interesting was that I think because we had structured the bill initially as a balance that was trying to take into account the different interests that people had, we actually didn't make that many changes in response to those meetings. You know, initially, I think that many of the credit holders were frustrated with the idea that they would have to give a discount, candidly. They were kind of like, what are you talking about? You owe us this money. And then we would sit down and we would kind of walk through time value of money and what the alternative was. And I think over time, I think people started to see that it was a fair balance of interests, that it wasn't necessarily skewed one way or another, and so people kind of gravitated to it as a solution.
Thank you. And after Representative Seaton, we'll go to invited testimony. We've got a few folks here calling in from New York. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of concerned that we're kind of offered this as a two different scenarios, either a 10% or a 5.1% scenario, yet all of the qualified for lower rates are going to be quite different among different producers or different explorers, so that the agreement to an overriding royalty interest, first of all, I'm now hearing that you at Revenue are going to do that instead of DNR, but the amount of value for an overriding royalty interest might be quite different among projects, and the time delay of that overriding royalty interest and when that would come through. But then I also heard on the royalty interest that as soon as the state got up to where the 10% would have been, then it goes away. And I'm not sure how we're writing that overriding royalty interest and whether that is kind of fair to the state when we reduce the interest rate that far and say, but as soon as some calculation in the future goes, then it stops. Could you address both of those things?
Sure, and thank you, through the chair, thank you, Co-Chair Seaton, for that question, because it allows me to clarify one feature. When I said a moment ago that the state would be examining these plans for reinvestment, I intended that to mean just the plans for reinvestment. So the overriding royalty interest is something that the Department of Natural Resources will be negotiating, and that will not be the Department of Revenue. So that will be a function of the Department of Natural Resources, whereas the plan for reinvestment will be examined and approved by the Department of Revenue. So kind of a distinction there. I think that the intent of the bill with respect to these overriding royalty interests would be that the credit holder would have the right to present a plan, a proposal, and then the Department of Natural Resources would examine that proposal based on kind of their view of the opportunity. And so the intent was that it would provide, that the state would be taking some risk with the field developer, but also sharing in the upside. And so if we implied that once that 10% was paid off, the ORI would disappear, I don't think that is what the bill intends. In other words, I do imagine that a company could say, we want to give you a royalty interest that lasts 10 years or something, and then DNR would say, okay, we'll evaluate that based on the time value of money and the risk and return, and there would be scenarios under that where the state could lose, you know, may not make as much as they expected, but there would be scenarios where the state would actually make considerably more. I think our expectation is that if someone gives an ORI as a general matter, at least this is my expectation, and we should have DNR come testify, but that it would be for the life of the field, and there would be risk to the state, but there would be upside opportunity for the state as well. And it's not the intent that we bear all the risk, but there's no upside associated with that ORI.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the things is that generally plans of development get delayed; they don't get accelerated. Right. So I was worried about this time commitment. So, and Mr. Chairman, I had a couple more, but since we have people on with New York, would it be better to just go to that testimony and then come back?
Maybe I also have in the queue here Representative Guerra and Pruitt. We do have two people from New York, and then Mr. Commissioner Fisher has to leave, I believe, at 2:30. Are they shorter? Because we can always bring
I can come back.
I'll
later.
In fact, I will come back as soon as I can.
Okay.
Okay. I can hold him.
Okay. Maybe let's go ahead and Representative Guerra and then Pruitt, and then we can bring the commissioner back if needed.
Thank you. Commissioner, so I think the bill has a lot of pros and a lot of cons, and I understand the policy, and it would be a lot easier for me to vote for had we raised some oil revenue, but it seems like money only goes one way right now. So the $600 million, the oil tax bill we passed last year would have easily paid for this, and so that makes it harder for me, but I get the pros and cons. Here's one of the pros, oddly enough, is that if we don't take action, there's a provision in the law right now, and I want to get your comments on this. There's a provision in the law right now that lets the oil industry come in, the more profitable companies, the biggest companies, and buy these credits for sort of a fraction of a dollar, but deduct a full dollar from their taxes. And so I'm concerned about that. A massive liability in the hundreds of millions of dollars coming to the state with those huge deductions if BP, Conoco, and Exxon start buying up these credits for 60 cents on the dollar. And I guess my question for you is, did you consider allowing the state that same sort of great benefit we've given the major oil companies, the ability to offer to purchase these credits for less than what they're worth, just like the major oil companies are allowed?
So through the chair, We've been asked that question before, and I guess there's two things that we were trying to balance. First of all, there's no question that there are certain companies that I think will sell their credits for a deep discount, you know, let's say 60 cents on the dollar. But I don't think that extends to all of the companies. And so one of our goals was to try to address this once and for all for the state and for the industry, and so I think we were concerned that they wouldn't we couldn't clean it up by doing that. Secondly, I think our objective was to try to provide a solution that was a balance, and I'm not necessarily trying to suggest that this is the best financial decision for the state. I think it's fair when you think about that it's neutral to modestly positive for the state. It requires the credit holders to bear the cost of the interest, and I think it is a thoughtful and becoming a respected solution by industry and by the financial industry that I think serves the state well in the long term, that when this crisis happened, that we kind of worked our way through it in a way that was balanced and fair to everyone. And so I felt, speaking for myself, that balancing these various interests in the way that this bill did was appropriate and in the long term better off for the state than trying to do something that may create some modest improvement financially for the state but create other long term resentment and consequences.
Representative Guerra?
So it was considered to give the state the same right that the major oil companies have to buy these credits at less than face value, or that wasn't considered?
Well, through the chair, we are buying them at less than the face value. We never, I mean, the question has been asked, and we never really deeply considered a deep discount, to be honest with you, when we did our modeling. It was trying to balance these other factors that resulted in the proposal that we came forward with.
Thanks.
Thank you. And we've got Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to make this quick. I definitely want to get on line with the bankers. But this question really relates to the bankers as well as yourself. It's the I don't know if we've stressed the importance of because there's been some concerns, maybe it's some misgivings or whatnot, about how this money, where this money will go. There's been concerns that have been expressed here and in other venues, other places, that if this were to potentially go to pay off banks and how that would essentially – that could not necessarily bring the benefit that we're after. Could you express, and it'd be, and I'd really appreciate this from the bankers, how important it is that even if this money were to just go straight through to a bank, that still is opening up the opportunity for the investment. That's not a bad thing in any way, shape, or form because of the effects of what can come from having some of these liabilities that are currently out there paid off.
Thank you, through the chair. Yes, I think that what you've said is accurate, and there's two dimensions to it. First of all, just at a high level, it's very difficult for a company that is in default on some piece of credit to attract either additional debt or equity investment. They're generally the representations and warranties that would be required in that kind of a transaction would require them to disclose that. And the existence of that debt, one of the reasons why it's a challenge is the existence of that debt arguably gives the debt holder, the bank, the ability to put that company into bankruptcy. And that threat, even if the bank is in forbearance, that threat makes future investors uncomfortable with the credit of that entity. And so cleaning up the balance sheet has a tremendous benefit. These companies will understand that these credits are not going to be issued and kind of the rules around it, so they'll structure their debt based on the cash flow that they do expect, and I think they can structure a capital structure that will be more sustainable long term. One of the things I think you will also hear that ING, when they testified in House Resources, also made it clear that they are over-collateralized. And so they may have, I'm making this up, they may have $100 million of debt and $140 million of credits. I'm just making those numbers up, meaning that when they get paid, there will, in fact, be some money that will also be returned to the companies. And so I think that at least what I understood their testimony to say was that they would, in fact, there would be money that would be coming back to the companies and would be available for the company for their operations.
Thank you. I also would like to recognize that we're joined by both Representatives Birch and Rauscher earlier. Thanks for being here. And so with that, I'd like to move over to invited testimony. First up, we have our lending institutions. We have Peter Clinton, Managing Director of Credit Restructuring, as well as Thomas Ryan, Managing Director for Structured Financing from ING Capital. They're on the line. If you are both there, if you could just put yourselves on the record, your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. This is Thomas Ryan, Managing Director at ING Capital in New York.
And this is Peter Clinton, Managing Director at ING Capital in New York, in charge of credit restructurings.
Great. Thank you for being here. If you could go ahead and proceed.
Yeah, so thanks for the opportunity to speak again. I think there's really only a couple of points that we kind of want to make. We made similar points at the Resource Committee hearings a couple of weeks ago, in that, you know, we've been working with two specific lenders or borrowers in Alaska, both of whom are nearing full production and one is close to full production. And, you know, we financed these tax credits beginning in 2015. Those loans are still outstanding, we're past due, we're in default, and we've been working with these companies to restructure these loans for the last couple of years. I think one of the things that's a key hallmark of these transactions are that we provided short-term liquidity to these companies at very, very cheap rates against these tax credits in the expectation that they would be repaid, cashed out quickly Obviously, that's not happened, and the term of those loans have been extended, even though they're in default. This money was spent by the companies already in Alaska, significant amounts of money, both debt that they raised as well as equity that they raised has been spent, and the equity or the credit money was cash that was expected to come back from the state in which we lent against. Clearly, circumstances have changed over the last number of years. We're all very, very aware of how things have evolved and developed. And we've been patient and worked as diligently as we can, both with the state and with the companies, to sort of keep them liquid and keep them in operation. But both of those companies have significant capital investment plans going forward. Both of those companies have further capital lined up to finance those plans. And as Mr. Fisher said, you know, the fact that they have defaulted debt on their balance sheets is preventing them from being, you know, going forward with a lot of those plans, and they've been basically trying to just stay afloat these last few years. We are over-collateralized, so I think one of the things that's been clearly been brought up in the testimony is that there's a concern that somehow that there's going to be a sort of the money's going to be taken and run. That's not the case. ING is a committed lender to the state of Alaska. We lend to several different industries in Alaska, and we will continue to do so. We do good business in Alaska. There's no reason to suggest that would change. And then, as I've mentioned, a lot of the money that these credits were coming back against has already been spent, and there will be excess that will go back to the projects to spend further, as well as raising new capital. So. And Peter can talk a little bit more about the restructuring, but you know what we've been asking for from the very beginning is that you know that we sort of restructure, if you like, the debt on the balance sheet. And restructuring it means that there will be everybody has to take a little bit of pain in that restructuring. The credits are being sort of bought, refinanced at a discount to par value which is what was originally expected. But, you know, we are realistic that there's something that just has to be done. And then once the balance sheets are cleaned up, there will be the possibility for these projects to refinance themselves and to continue their operations.
So this is Peter Clinton. As it relates to the bill itself, you know, I think it's fair to say, as Thomas said, this did not work out the way it was intended for anyone, either the companies that generated the credits, the banks that lent against the credits, nor the state, who had historically paid the credits at a certain rate and, you know, intended to do so going forward. This isn't unlike a private credit restructuring when there is some event that was unforeseen, that somehow has an impact on a company's revenues or earnings that makes them unable to pay the debts that they had originally, you know, contracted for. And, you know, there's a typical pattern that, you know, we go through with private companies when those situations arise, and it's not too dissimilar from what we've experienced here. The big difference is the period of time, because we work, you know, in kind of these annual legislative sessions where we have to try to knock off one problem at a time. And I think, you know, the first thing that was done was consistent with what we would see in a private company, and that is that you stop making the payments until you could, you know, figure out what critical payments that you had to make, and those are the tough decisions that everybody makes because you've got you know many other you know priorities within the state that have to be paid. That was number one. Number two, you needed to define the size of the problem, and you did that when you stopped you know issuing the tax credits and ended up to where you are today, where now you need to solve the problem and how you pay those. And I think that what has been said is worth repeating. This is it's a fair, it's a balanced proposal. It is consistent with the type of proposals you would see in private industry, where you take an obligation that you recognize that you have and you try to get a solution to that problem where everybody participates. And I think that's what you've asked in this bill. You've asked those who owe the money to accept some type of discount. You ask those who benefit from the program to commit, if they can, to reinvest in the state so that they are, you know, making this money, for this money work again for you. And it really is your problems in that it takes, you know, near-term appropriations and it spreads them out over a period of time. And while I appreciate there's some concern that there's not great visibility out over a 10-year period with respect to, you know, repayment capacity, you know, that's, that again is not dissimilar from other types of organizations. Your crystal ball can only take you out, you know, a few years. Like, you have to rely on your history and you have to rely on the fundamentals that you know them, that you're going to be able to make those payments. And so I think, you know, collectively the proposal that's on the table makes a lot of sense for everybody involved. It is true to a formula that's used in the private sector, and it's something that should work for everybody.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Clinton. We've got a question first from Representative Wilson and then Gren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So who will make the decision on what kind of discount? Will the bank do that, or will the company? I mean, who actually owns the credits right now?
Well, that's an excellent question, actually. And so when one of the positive features of this program is that when we finance the credits, we essentially purchase them from the company. So the tax credits are issued in our name. ING is the recipient, and they were assigned to us. So having said that, I think, as Mr. Fisher mentioned, we are over-collateralized, and we have an obligation to give back to the companies anything in excess of what we're owed. So it'll be a joint decision. We will look at, you know, what the final capital investment plans are for the company going forward. By the way, we're extremely supportive of our borrowers, and nothing we would enjoy more than to see them be successful. So we're extremely, you know, we work very, very closely with them, and the relationship is extremely symbiotic. So we'll have to look at what their capital expenditure plans are. We'll have to look at what the right discount will be as a function of that. And then we'd have to decide sort of collectively what the right strategy is for the company and for us, because clearly they need money, they have capital plans of their own, and we want to make sure they have that money. And then a lot of it will also come down to the final details of the plan. Is it possible, for example, to split the credits into one bucket that's discounted at one rate, another bucket at another rate? Some of the details we're still working on, and we would welcome the opportunity to speak to Mr. Fisher as well about that as we go forward.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So let's say the credit was worth $100 million, and you were given $90 million because, I mean, you as a bank aren't going to do the work. The company would have to. So then that $10 million difference, would that then, I'm assuming then the company would then have to make up that difference?
If we're over-collateralized, yes. We have two deals. They're two quite different deals. One is over-collateralized to a fairly large extent. The other isn't. Depending on the exact final details of the plan as well as the plans of the company, we may end up taking a loss on one deal, and then the other deal will probably have some excess that will go back to the company. So, to answer your question, depending on the size of the discount, some of it will be borne by us in one case, and then all of it will be borne by the company in the other. But again, it's until we have the exact final details, it's hard to exactly predict, but that's what we expect.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I guess I'm just trying to get on record because I understand that if the company owns it, then they could, you know, guarantee that they're going to do so much work in the next couple of years. I'm not sure how the bank, and maybe, you know, we could get this back in writing, how the bank could make that same obligation. So I want to make sure that we're not putting the banks at a disadvantage because they can only do the 10% discount. They can't do the 5% because they're not the ones who are going to be doing the work. So I'm just trying to figure out the difference between the bank owning the note and the company. But thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
And next up we have Representative Gren.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for being on the phone today, gentlemen. You used the term fair and balanced, and perhaps this makes a lot of sense to everyone involved, and I wanted to use those as framing a conversation we had this weekend regarding our state's reputation on the last few years in creating a confidence or hurting the confidence in our state oil and gas tax policy. Compared to the status quo, I guess, or how we've handled the tax credits the last few years, how, in your opinion, I guess, in your sector, how would this proposal, if it were to pass, how would it impact our reputation regarding investment and such in our oil and gas tax policy?
This is Peter Clinton. From my personal perspective, I think it would greatly enhance your reputation. It might be easier to address that almost from the other side of the question, or the question not asked, is that how much is the reputation hurt by not doing something like this? And I think that the answer to that question is it has hurt a lot. I think, as I said, it's lenders, you know, private lenders are not put off by situations like this where something unexpected happens and you have to figure out a way to deal with it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what they look for in the solution is for the ability for there to be a predictable payout. You know, personally speaking here, our job is to go back to our senior management and to be able to manage their expectations with respect to how long it's going to take to get to pay them and when they're going to get to be paid. And if we have to go back every year and say, A, it's subject to appropriations, and B, as it relates to those appropriations, there is a disagreement with respect to what the right amount is, then that doesn't lead to this predictability. If you do a program such as this bond, where even if it pays something off at a discount over a longer term, I think that institutions are more than happy to accept that that trade-off, the trade-off for predictability as opposed to perhaps something a little less off of your face amount. And as we spoke about from ING's perspective on one of our loans, perhaps that won't lead to a loss because we have over-collateralization. And another one, it may lead to a small loss. But even in those cases where it leads to a loss, for us anyway, it's a much more desirable outcome than the uncertainty that would continue to exist if we weren't able to come up with a solution like this.
Representative Grin.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the comments.
Representative Guerra and then Pruitt.
Thank you. Mr. Clinton, this whole reputation thing has me scratching my head a little bit. So for many years, the state paid the credits as they came in. And then, as you noted, there was uncertainty, and we were all hit with a oil price crash in 2015 that nobody anticipated, and that hurt everybody, including the state. But since then, when we stopped paying every single dollar, we shifted towards what the statute says, which is we paid 10% of the production tax revenue if oil was over $60 a barrel, and by statute 15% if oil was under $60 a barrel. So we followed the statute. At some points earlier on, we were paying the full amounts every year. And then we had a fiscal crisis, and then we started following the statutory formula. And if we kept doing that, I mean, why would that hurt our reputation? It's I almost feel like we're being blamed for. I assume that your bank read the statute before you lent the money. We all want to come up with a solution, but the reputation thing sort of bothers me because we've been following the law, and I'm just curious. Did the bank just did your bank read the law on the payment formula before issuing these?
Just 1 second, please. Oh,
Yeah, so look, there's no question that when we entered into the lending against these credits, we were very much aware of the terms of the program and the formula and the suggested formula. We're also aware of, you know, sort of the history and the performance, historical performance. And, you know, we're mindful that, of course, in legislation, in budgeting, you can't bind future years of budget. So when we were sort of due diligencing the credits and our willingness to lend against them, we spoke to a lot of people in the state. We spoke to a lot of people in the Department of Revenue. We spoke to people in the DNR. We spoke to the governor's office. And, you know, we're all aware of what happened, and we were all aware going into it that there could potentially be some point in the future an event that could slow down the payments to the formula. And so we stress-tested those kind of those payments, and we stress-tested those scenarios. And based on both representations that we sort of had from various stakeholders we spoke to in Alaska, as well as our own modeling, we felt comfortable with the event risk. There's no question the event has happened. It took us all by surprise. And so I don't think anybody is saying that the state is not honoring its the letter of the law and the legislation. However, there was some reasonable expectations that were made, and there were some discussions that were had with some serious stakeholders in Alaska prior to making our decision. And I think based on a sort of a willingness to pay and an ability to pay of the state, I think what we've been asking for at some point throughout this whole process has been some predictability. And as a bank, we would like to lend more. As our projects would like some certainty. And, you know, if there's no question as well as when these projects and the equity was put into these projects in Alaska, there was you know, promises made of prompt payment of credits in exchange for cash. So I don't disagree with you that the relationship of the state is a good one, but we think that this bill, by adding some clarity and some certainty at a discount, and again sharing the pain amongst all the stakeholders, will certainly help show you know, that the state, both in terms of goodwill and compliance with the legislation, is a good place to do business. And our own experience in terms of our visits there over the last several years of dealing with people, you know, on the legislature as well as the DNR and DOR, has all been very, very positive. And we are hopeful that if this bill gets passed, we will continue to do business in Alaska.
All right, thanks.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time out to join us today. I wanted to, earlier on in your testimony, you had referenced kind of the genesis of when you started working with some of these companies. You made a comment about you offered liquidity at cheap rates, and it was based on the program. It was based on the precedent we had set with the program that we would pay them off in a short term, therefore giving you the ability. I'm assuming, and this is why I wanted to ask, I'm assuming that meant that there was terms that would either allow for lower interest rates or certain payments that schedules that took into account that we would pay that back within a reasonable amount of time. But you also then expressed that you have been working with these companies and renegotiating that. And I think one of the terms utilized was a little bit of pain has been. Can you express exactly what have you, without getting into confidential information, and I'm not asking for that, don't feel there's any pressure for that, but as you've had to adjust and reorganize this debt, what has that typically been? Whether is that addition, higher interest rates? Is that what is the effect of not being able to pay for these things and you readjusting the debt?
So this is Peter Clinton. That would be typical in any credit restructuring. So a general loan agreement, this isn't giving away anything confidential, would include in a loan agreement a default rate, which is generally 2% above the original rate that you contracted for. And so our default rate was put into place when this loan was not able to be repaid when it became due. We had other rights and remedies available to us, which we did not but you know, we did not choose to do, and that is we could have foreclosed. We could have caused the company to file for bankruptcy by taking certain actions. That wasn't going to get us paid any quicker. It wasn't going to solve the company's problems. There are other creditors involved in these companies who were standing aside, waiting for certain developments to happen to see if those developments would lead these companies back to financial health. And so we kind of stood by. Really, we didn't, since the only source of our payment was through the tax credits, and it was only secondarily that we would ever get paid from any type of cash flow from the fields, we stood by and really let these other creditors kind of control the outcome. And we stayed in close contact with those creditors as well as the company so that it was kind of a coordinated effort at the end of the day.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So my follow-up on that, and I understand I'm not talking to individuals who deal with taxes necessarily, but typically is interest utilized, is it, can you use your interest against a tax liability, therefore meaning less tax available to whether it's the federal government, the state entity, whatever, the interest being a cost of doing business. Is that typically your experience?
I'm not part of our finance department, so I'm not sure that. I mean, we have a cost of doing business, obviously, but that is, you know, we have other costs that are implied costs that aren't balance sheet costs. They are calculated the way we think of how we do business. We have cost of capital. We have things called risk-weighted assets, capital that we set aside based on the quality of assets that we have. And when you have a $100 million loan that is past due without any immediate visibility into how that loan is going to get repaid, then you have a lot of capital set aside against that loan. And if you have capital set aside against that loan, that is capital you can't use for new loans, perhaps to new clients that would be safer clients and paying on a current basis.
Were you speaking about the interest expense for our customers? So if that's the question, then yes, typically their interest expense is deductible against their tax liability.
Against theirs.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that was what I was expressing was the interest expense for the customers. So this actually, the interest paid to you is actually going to affect and mean a lower amount of tax that would be available to us because of the fact that it's a cost of doing business. So we're actually affecting our ability to get additional tax within this state. One last question or follow-up, Mr.
Representative Pruitt.
Mr. Chair. And I think you just highlighted it. You just touched on it. With this being out there and this being something for several of these companies that has been kind of on their balance sheets, it's been they have not been able to pay it off. That has prevented you from being able to put capital out into the streets, back into some of these companies that are looking to expand what they're trying to do, whether it's on the North Slope or in the Cook Inlet. Not having these paid off, it has, and I guess I'm looking for confirmation that it has, it's prevented you from putting money back into or capital back into the Alaska oil and gas sector, especially for the companies that might have some of these tax credits. Would that be a correct statement or thought process?
Yes, I can confirm that's the case. I can give you an example. ING runs a fairly significant oil and gas business out of a Houston office that we have, where we probably have a portfolio equal to $2.5 billion, somewhere in that order, and maybe 40, 50 different borrowers. And since the beginning of the energy crisis, probably somewhere in the order of 10, 12 of those borrowers filed for bankruptcy. They went through the formal bankruptcy process. We were fortunate in most of those instances that the level that we lent at was not impaired, but there were significant losses to other investors that were incurred. ING continues to lend to those companies after they've come out of bankruptcy. ING continues to make new loans in the oil and gas, the production industry down in Houston. And as I alluded to earlier, what we look for is kind of the process, the predictability of the outcome. And then once we know that stuff, we're able to do the financial analysis that we do customarily to assess whether or not the next opportunity to lend to that company makes sense. The fact that they had incurred some problems previously does not exclude us from lending to them again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we'll go to Representative Guerra and then over to our industry invited testimony. Representative Guerra.
Yeah, no, Mr. Clinton, Mr. Ryan, I just want to say I appreciate the tone of your testimony. There's some in industry have been a little more disappointing in their tone, but you've rightly recognized that we've honored our obligations, and I understand that you've been working with the state to try and find a way out of this, and I appreciate it, but I also appreciate the tone that you presented your testimony in.
Eddies, Mr. Chair.
Eddies.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clinton.
House Finance back on record at 2:37 p.m. And I would just ask members, it's good to express an appreciation for the folks who testify, and I would just ask folks to be careful about what others might infer from some of our statements. So with that, let's go to our industry testimony. Kara Moriarty, if you could put yourself on the record. We have three people, Ms. Kara Moriarty, Pat Foley, and Jeff Hastings. Ms. Moriarty, if you could put yourself on the record, your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Seaton, I see Co-Chair Seaton may not be sitting there right now as I look at the TV, but I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. As you know, AOGA is a private trade association that represents the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, and transporters of Alaska's oil and gas. And our very brief testimony today does reflect the opinion of our entire membership. So AOGA has long supported an expedited resolution to refund the earned tax credits. And we are encouraged that the governor and his team, especially Commissioner Fisher, came forward with a very innovative idea that you have in front of you today. These companies, as was discussed extensively on Saturday, you know, the companies earn these credits by already spending hundreds of millions of dollars investing in Alaska, hiring Alaskans so that they could explore and produce oil. And the tax credit payment system was to allow for a rebate, if you will, after that money was spent. So the company companies would spend money, then they would come to the state and seek a credit, then they would get their credit certificate, and then they would be paid. So I think it's important to remind us of that. As has been mentioned, the delay in getting these rebates paid in full has damaged the state's reputation and has chilled future investment, and it has caused projects to be shelved, and the delay has resulted in negative economic impacts to the state and local communities. So we believe the state should honor all of our outstanding earned tax credits in full and in as expedited process as possible. As I mentioned, we do think House Bill 331 is a very innovative approach that seeks to refund a portion of the earned credits by a bonding to raise the money, then refunding the credits at a reduced rate. And as you know, the governor proposes to lower the refunding rate to then cover the state's bond finance costs so that there's no additional cost to the state. Now, the industry would prefer that these credits be paid in full, as Commissioner Fisher testified to today, and we would prefer that there was not a discount rate, but we also understand the balance of having certainty and that these payments, even at a reduced rate, getting paid sooner rather than later, are very important to our member companies. So we are committed to working with the administration and the legislature to find an equitable solution, and we do applaud the administration and many legislators for acknowledging that refunding these tax credit payments is a critical step this session. So we do support getting the credits paid sooner rather than later to send a strong signal to investors like you just heard on the phone that Alaska is open for business and so that companies can attract much-needed new investment to continue to provide jobs, produce more oil, and continue a strong economy moving forward. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to address any questions that anyone might have.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Moriarty. We've got questions from Representative Grin and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Moriarty. You usually testify when you have unanimous consent from all of your members. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Grin, yes, on matters of tax, which tax credits is part of tax policy, I do have to have unanimous consent when I testify, and the testimony that I provided today is no different.
Follow up.
And not all of the members you speak for are owed tax credits. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Grin, that is correct. But those companies that do not have tax credit certificates that have been earned, they are supportive of getting the credits paid sooner rather than later because it having a healthy oil business, whether it's a small company or a big company, is important to the entire industry. So we all recognize that we need to have strong companies across the board, if you will. So I do represent companies like Kalis and PetroStar and companies like that that are holding tax credit certificates that have not been getting their payments in full and have that has hampered their ability to continue to do business or to attract investment in Alaska. To those companies who were never eligible for cash payments, like BP and Exxon, and Hillcourt now no longer qualifies for these cash credit certificates, which there won't be any more into the future anyway. So, again, we look at these issues holistically, and having a healthy business climate for all companies is very important to all of my membership.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we've got Representative Wilson and then Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, are your members concerned about the additional portion now that you have to be doing something, I guess, within the next 2 years to put that money back into Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we The companies that are members of AOGA are very committed to the state of Alaska. And, you know, again, we would prefer that the credits were paid in full with no strings attached, if you will, because we spent the money and we believe those credits are owed. But we also recognize the position that the state is in, and they are trying to find an innovative approach when prices are still in this lower for longer range. And most of the companies that, I mean, I think all the companies that I represent, they plan to be in Alaska. So putting together development plans to make the discount contingent on future spending, I haven't heard any objections to, except the fact that, you know, again, in a perfect world, we'd like to be paid in full and not have any type of discount. But I think the companies that I represent are very committed to the state of Alaska.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is it your understanding, though, and I didn't think about that until you just said it, so if they already have a development plan that they're going forward with or without the credits, would you hope that would be the intent of DOR to utilize that plan as the way that they're going to reinvest some of this money?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you know, I think that's something we just need to work through with the state. I need better clarification if they're expecting a brand new development plan or something that's already in place as we move forward. But again, I think the companies that would take advantage of this program will work closely with the state, and if they have to provide something additional, hopefully it won't be any more onerous than what they've already had to provide for their lease in the first place.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson,
I'm just putting it on the record. When they come back, I don't know what they could do during the section or the other, but are in-state refineries underneath the same obligation for 2 years as the other oil tax credits? They weren't quite written the same way in until she mentioned PetroStar in her presentation. I just want to make sure that maybe because some of the credits were different, are they still underneath that 2 years? Because that may actually be an issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I just want to mention, I think some folks may be calling in interested in testifying. Right now, we are doing today public, invited testimony. And when we come back to our meeting tomorrow at 1:30, we will be doing public testimony. So I just want to let folks know who might be calling in. Public testimony will be tomorrow, and invited testimony is today. So with that, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Moriarty, I just wanted to get it on the record. You made a couple of statements that I feel maybe need to be pointed out to the public a little clearer. You made a statement there was hundreds of millions of dollars invested by these companies. In actuality, if you look at it all, I'm sure it's into well over a billion or billions of dollars have been invested. And the fact then that these companies could then submit to the state and they would only get a percentage back in a tax credit, I felt like you said that they would get their money back. But, you know, I just wanted to make it clear that there's been several billion dollars invested because of the incentives and that those companies are only get a smaller percentage back in a tax credit.
Representative Thompson, through the chair, you are correct. I didn't mean to overgeneralize. I was, you know, trying to be brief in my comments and probably became too general. You are correct. I think if you look back at these companies, what they've invested is over billions, and they do not get to get all of their money back, but the portion that was part of the credit as stated in law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Moriarty? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Moriarty. Next, we'll go to Pat Foley. If you could put yourself on the record, your name and your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling in from Anchorage today. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay. So thank you for allowing me to speak with you today, and thank you for the entire committee for giving this bill your attention. It's late in the session. You've got a lot of important business to do, and I very much appreciate your action on this bill. So for the record, my name is Pat Foley. I'm a senior vice president with Kalis Alaska, and I run all of our Alaska operations. And I think today this bill maybe represents the end of an era. Pioneer started our business in Alaska in 2002 under PPP. Between Pioneer and Kalis, we've invested over $2 billion here in the state. We've participated in about a dozen exploration wells. We've developed a Gurek. We've commenced our operations on our Nuna development, and we've made a very substantial discovery out in Smith Bay. And all of this work has been done under various tax credit programs that helped assist our financing. All of the credits have ended under HB 111, and it's HB 331 that will bring to an end the state's obligation to repay these tax credits. I think we can all agree that the state has been the beneficiary of quite a number of items as a result of the investments that these companies have made. And I think we can all agree that the large number of investments in the state is beneficial, and a diverse population of explorers and developers is also beneficial. And finally, I think we can all agree that Alaska is a high-cost environment, and there are substantial barriers to entry. And it's the tax credit program that began, you know, more than a decade ago that helped go a long way to level the playing field between the large existing legacy producers and the new companies trying to grow and incubate their business here in Alaska. And the state has seen benefits from all the tax credit programs through jobs, through production down tax taps, and through increased royalty payments. Ms. Moriarty hit on this. I just wanted to reiterate, it's not the big legacy producers that have been the beneficiary of the recent tax credit programs. It's companies like Kalis and Repsol and Brooks Range, Great Bear, Doyon, Siri, ASRC, Bluecrest, Fury, and SAE. These are the companies that have made the investments, and these are the companies that are entitled to the payments that hopefully will result under this bonding program. If this bill is able to become law, and if the credits are paid to the bonding program, it demonstrates the state's making great steps to help with its reputation. It demonstrates the state making good on its obligations that were created under the incentive programs. And most importantly, it helps put money back in the hands of developers, and that should allow new investments to be made here in the state. So shifting specifically to HB 331, I believe it represents good policy, and I believe it represents both a win for the state and a win for the investors. The credit holders, they'll be paid out earlier than what the statutory minimum formula would provide. Yes, we take a small haircut. It's a discount that we're willing to accept. And the amount of that discount, the interest cost of that repayment, so to speak, is similar to our actual cost of capital at 10%. If we're able to enjoy the lower discount rate, it's actually economical money, and I think it's a fair deal for both the state and the investor. The state helps clear all of its obligations to repay the taxes, And from a cash flow standpoint, the state minimizes its 2018 cash obligations. Absent this program, I believe the statutory minimum obligates a payment of about $184 million, and I believe Commissioner Fisher testified earlier that the interest payment that the state would incur in 2018 is closer to $27 million. And I think it's also good policy that the bill provides two different discount rates, because quite simply it creates an incentive for more activities here in the state. It encourages investors to plow that money right back here into the state. I want to thank Representative Wilson, who over the weekend helped remind the committee that the tax credit holders have made, you know, literally billions of dollars investments here in the state, and those investments have resulted in jobs and production and royalties and other tangible benefits to the state, and those investments have earned the tax credit certificates, and it's the repayment of those tax credit certificates that this bonding program will resolve. And then finally, I'd like to thank the administration for making it a priority to repay the tax credit obligation that exists. And I ask that this committee pass HB 331, and I ask that ultimately the legislature vote it into law. Thank you for being allowed the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Foley. We've got a question from Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Foley, thanks for calling in. Are you able to share the amount that Kalis is owed in tax credits?
Representative Grin, to the chair, it's a private confidential matter, but yes, I have spoken to this before, and I'm not ashamed of it. The punchline for Kalis, we are the holder of nearly $190 million of tax credit certificates.
So Mr. Foley, so if this were to become, if this proposal was law, what would the day after look like for Kalis? If you woke up the next morning and this was passing the law, what would be happening at Kalis?
So, Representative Grin, to the chair. One, we'd be happy. We'd be pleased that the state was able to fulfill its obligation to us. And most importantly, we have that $190 million in tax credit certificates. We do have loans against a substantial portion of that. We'd be in a position to pay off those loans. And most importantly, we'd be in a position to attract additional investment through either equity or debt or a combination to allow us to go forward at full speed with Nuna and hopefully to drill an additional appraisal well out in Smith Bay. None of that's automatic. None of that's guaranteed. But this should set the environment to facilitate other investments here in the state.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony and for investing in our state and believing in us. And I appreciate that you've met your obligation. But the one thing I'm still concerned about, and I'd like to know how the company would be, so are you comfortable with the added requirements now to be able to get the higher discount?
Representative Wilson, to the chair, yes, I am. And I believe Kalis will be in a position to make investments here in the state that exceed the $190 million tax credit certificates. And I'm confident that we will be entitled to the lower discount rate. Having said that, even if we weren't, if it were discounted at 10%, we'd have to go out in the market. We'd have to borrow more money. The cost to acquire that is probably going to be something in the neighborhood of 10%. It may be a little higher. It may be a little lower. But that is probably our actual cost to go borrow money.
I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
And did you end up putting anything on hold because you were waiting for these tax credits to be paid?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes and no. I hate to say that it is absolutely a direct connection. However, the fact that the credits weren't being paid, the fact that there's always the continuing conversation in the legislature to reshuffle the production taxes, it makes it very difficult for us to attract investment dollars. Kalis has been out in the marketplace for well more than a year, trying to obtain financing for both our Nuna development and additional work out at Smith Bay. And it's been very difficult, and I can say we have yet to be successful. Hopefully, this will be a first step that facilitates our ability to attract capital.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And again, thank you for the investment and for everything you're doing. We look to be better partners with you. Thank you.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Foley, for taking the time today. You may not have this offhand, but can you give me an idea of the correlation of what that $190 million meant in terms of Alaskan jobs and potential oil through the pipeline? And then my follow-up, the second question, would if now you are able to go out and get another $190 million worth of capital, and I'm just using the same term, not committing you that you would directly go out and get that amount, but what would that mean in terms of future jobs and future oil potential?
Representative Future. So let me try and hit a couple of those. So yes, Kalis and Pioneer, we have had as many as 900 employees and contractors working for us simultaneously on the slope. Today, as I wake up, that number is, it takes more than both hands to count, but it's well less than 50 that we have working on the North Slope and maybe another 50 here in town. We have Agouric, and again, Agouric totally has been developed in some kind of a tax credit program. I think we've made about 30 million barrels of production so far. My daily production this morning was a little over 13,000 barrels a day. The way as to what we will do in the future, our Nuna development is the next development project we hope to get going on very soon. Nuna is, and I apologize for not having the exact number, but it's something in the neighborhood of 150 million barrels plus. Peak production is about 25,000 barrels a day. Peak jobs will be over 200 or 300 during the construction phase. And the total investment for Nuna will be something north of $1 billion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Foley? I don't see any questions. So thank you for your invited testimony, Mr. Foley. The last person we have with invited industry testimony is Mr. Jeff Hastings. If you could put your name and your affiliation on the record.
Good afternoon. I'd like to start by extending my appreciation to Chairman Foster, Chairman Seaton, and members of the House Finance Committee for allowing us to participate in today's testimony. For the record, my name is Jeff Hastings. I'm the Chairman and the Chief Executive Officer for SA Exploration and the Managing Member for Kupik SAE, our joint venture with the North Slope Native Village of Nuiqsut. My family's lived in Alaska since 1987. Our core business is offering seismic data acquisition services to the oil and gas industry. We're not an oil company. We simply provide seismic data to help the state and the companies know where to look in order to find the oil more efficiently and more effectively. Our company has employed an average of 400 Alaskans annually. We are the holders of approximately $50 million of assigned credits and continue to wait for an additional $21 million in assigned credits, which are still in the process of being verified and audited for the past 2 years. Since we're not an oil company, we don't have any long-term production prospects for making up the money that is owed to the company for the work that we've performed. Instead, we've been forced to restructure and downsize the company as we wait for payments from the state of Alaska. Today, I'd like to talk in support of House Bill 331, which, if passed, will provide a mechanism to pay off the existing oil and gas tax credits owed by the state through an issuance of bonds. Over the past couple of years, we've felt adverse effects as a result of the prolonged period in which the oil and gas credits are verified, issued, and ultimately paid. As an Alaskan company and as Alaskans, we understand the state's fiscal dilemma and appreciate the legislature's effort to find long-term fiscal solutions. But circumstances are such that we need to work together today to find a solution, and we believe that House Bill 331 offers that pathway. In our sector of the industry, the seismic data collecting sector, we've experienced a continuing downward trend in activity since the governor's first veto appropriation in Q2 of 2015. Year over year, a 50% decrease in the dollars being spent on new data needed to identify new reserves that the state needs for its economic well-being. In 2015, $200 million was spent on new high-resolution seismic data. In 2018, there will be less than $20 million spent on new seismic data collection. Perhaps more importantly, though, are the jobs that have been lost and continue to be reduced year after year. As a company, we have gone from employing 400 Alaskans and multitudes of Alaskan subcontractors for 8 to 9 months a year to a company that employs 150 Alaskans and a few select Alaskan contractors for 45 days in 2018. This is not a result of a loss in our market share to competition or a continued downturn in the commodity price. It is simply due to a lack of capital spending, be it our clientele waiting on tax credits owed to them individually or a lack of confidence in the state's oil and gas tax policy. The capital budgets are being redirected to other basins and other opportunities where there is a higher level of confidence. The tax credit appropriation vetoes, the debate about annual minimum appropriations and the two DOR advisory bulletins, 2016-01, or 2016-01, and 2017-01, which effectively shut down the secondary market, have all combined to create a business environment without meaningful consistency. Please know that this is not trying to cast blame or fault anyone. All of us are doing our best to cope with the state's fiscal situation. But I point these things out to you today and hope that we can move forward with House Bill 331 as a solution. Working together and passing this bill will create opportunities and bring online the reserves that the state desperately needs to solve our fiscal gap, opportunities which are now effectively sidelined due to our current situation. Except for one expiration effort in 2018, the capital needed to get us back to work is not being allocated. Project after project suspended because of a lack of visibility, resulting in a lack of capital available, both institutional capital and private capital, to move projects forward because of a continued erosion of confidence in the consistency of our policy and plan to pay the outstanding credit liability. Recent data from the DOR would indicate that the 2016 and 2017 credits, depending on the annual appropriation, will not see payments begin until fiscal 2021 and may not see full amounts paid until sometime beyond fiscal 2024 or 2025. That data would indicate an even more protracted period of low activity. The DOR projections for commodity pricing over the near term show that we cannot depend on an increase in the price of oil to solve this issue. And yet, as a state, we need more production and more revenue generated by that production to bridge our fiscal gap and the future needs of the state. To do that, we need the industry off the sidelines and working to increase our throughput. We believe that House Bill 331 provides a path to restarting the industry's engine. Is it ideal? No. On one side of the equation, no one wants to take a haircut for money owed. On the other, you can argue why should the state take on the debt and the service of that debt, even if the discount provides an offset. The level of the discount will be accompanied by company choice and dependent on current projected payment by the DOR, their cost of capital, and the need for new project capital. What House Bill 331 does is to create confidence when the companies will be paid, how much they'll be paid, and normalizes the amount that the state will need to appropriate each year against the tax credit liability. More importantly, it gives us the ability and the confidence as an industry to find the capital we need for new or suspended projects. And it puts our Alaska families back to work. Thanks for your time today and the opportunity to share our viewpoint.
Thank you, Mr. Hastings. We have a question from Representative Thompson.
Mr. Co-Chair, it sounded like he was reading it. Could you have him please forward his testimony so we can have it on the record? I'd like to see it in writing.
Yeah, I have forwarded that.
You did? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Is there anything else that the committee would like to ask or comment on? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Hastings, for your testimony. So with that, let's move over to a sectional analysis. I believe, is it Mr. Ken Alper? Mr. Barnhill, I think you're sitting this one out. Is that correct? Okay. Mr. Alper, thank you for being here. If you could put yourself on the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, Tax Division Director, Department of Revenue. Sectional analyses are never that much fun, but I'm happy to go through the bill in as much detail as the committee requires. I could also potentially answer some of the questions that came up with some of the testimony raised earlier today if we want to go in that direction. There was a question on Saturday from Representative Kawasaki that I sort of gave a preview to the sectional itself, said that the bill does basically four things and said what they were. So I'm going to keep the structure of those four subtopics as I go through it in greater detail. Section one is a conforming section that has to do with the procurement code. And there are two new pieces of the bill where there's some new state activity that is explicitly going to not require going through the details of the state procurement process. One of them is the bond corporation themselves, and the second is the acquiring of those overriding royalty interests through the Department of Natural Resources in Section 11. So Section 1 is conforming, just to clarify that. Section 2 is one of those big sections because it's writing a whole new chapter into statute, AS 3718, creating a new state bond corporation for the purpose of the Alaska Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation within the Department of Revenue. And as Deputy Commissioner Barnhill said on Saturday, this section was modeled after very similar language. You can see parallels almost chapter and verse specific to the Pension Obligation Bond Corporation law that passed through this body about 10 years ago. So there's a lot of subsections within Section 2. It takes up a good half of the length of the bill. 3718.010 it creates the corporation itself. Of Section 020 establishes that there's a board of directors and there are three commissioners, revenue, commerce, and administration are the three commissioners of the corporation. 030 authorizes that they can sell up to $1 billion in bonds, and that's over, it's expected to be multiple bond issuances, although, as we said, the first one will be the so-called big one, roughly $700 million or so, presuming most companies or all companies participate in the program. 040 is the reserve fund. It's a lot of the meat of how the legislature in the future will appropriate money to pay the interest and the principal of these bonds. That language is spelled out in 040, which itself has a number of subsections, and it's some of the richer language. Deputy Commissioner Barnhill was quoting from 040 where he talked about those appropriations to the reserve fund. 050, again, these are sort of standard authorities for a bonding entity, authorizes the corporation to set the terms of the bond, and the last bonds will be issued by the end of 2021. That fits in with our expectation that the last cashable tax credits will come into the state sometime in 2020, that those being the last refinery credits and potentially the credit that the Interior Gas Utility will be requesting. I want to pause at this moment because Representative Wilson asked a question. It seems like a worthwhile moment. Those refinery credits automatically come into the system at the lower discount rate. That's a specific carve-out in a later section of the bill. What we were talking about earlier as far as getting the lower discount rate through a reinvestment commitment, that's external to the to those refinery credits. That's for the companies holding the more traditional operating loss or exploration spending type credits. And when I get to that section, I'll talk about it in a little greater detail, but I just wanted to clear the record on that while we were all here. So 060, the corporation has to issue a resolution to authorize the selling of the bonds, procedural stuff related to the corporation, enforcement rights in 070. The 080 puts a restriction that says we can only issue the bonds if we get a discount that's the equivalent of at least 1.5% above the total interest cost. Total interest cost is a standard financial term. It refers to the states, not just the interest itself, but the whatever fee there is associated with issuing it that the underwriters would get as their commission, essentially, gets rolled into this idea of a total interest cost. That plus 1.5 is where we got this roughly 5.1% that we spoke of the other day when we talked about modeling the cash flow for this program. So 090 is a repurchase ability that the corporation can buy them back prior to the maturity date if so desired. 100 says that they are an official legal instrument of the state. 800, this chapter shall be liberally construed to carry out its purposes. That word means different things to different people, but basically it authorizes the corporation to be able to do what it's being asked to do by the legislature, which is sell bonds, repurchase tax credits, and then service and eventually repay those bonds. 043.18.810 gives the corporation itself the ability to write regulations as necessary to implement the chapter. We don't foresee a lot of necessary regulations, especially given the tight timeline. The hope is that we would be going forward and selling these bonds within months after final passage of the bill. There are a handful of new definitions embedded within the the corporation section. So that's the bonding corporation, and if there are more detailed questions, Mr. Chairman, we probably need to go to Lifelines. I admit to not being the internal expert within the administration on that section of the bill.
But, Representative Wilson.
So just one question. So why are we setting up a whole, why are we creating the corporation? This is just a, for one specific purpose, it's time limited. Why a whole different corporation?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I know that this was the way it has been done in the past, specifically with the pension obligation bonds, and we sort of lifted it. As far as any legal reason or requirement to do so, I would probably need to punt that to someone else. Perhaps Deputy Commissioner Barnhill does, in fact, want to come and join me for that one.
He wants to.
We see you wanted to come up.
Exactly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. At the outside of the design and envisioning how to do this bill, we actually considered having the State Bond Committee issue the debt. It was on advice of tax counsel that specifically because the use of a corporation was approved by the Alaska Supreme Court in the Carr-Gottstein case, which you heard significant discussion about on Saturday, they thought it was a useful thing to include here. So that's the reason. And as Mr. Alper indicated, we recently used that structure in the, recently meaning 10 years ago, used that structure in the pension obligation bond context, thought it was a familiar structure for the legislature and actually didn't think it would be at all controversial.
Representative Wilson.
You obviously don't know us. But will this in automatically, without a sunset day, would it just automatically, you know, once the last payment's made, dissolve, or will this corporation stay in case somebody wants to utilize it for something else?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is no sunset clause in the bill. It would stay on the books until the legislature saw fit to repeal it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Barnhill, is there any reason why we wouldn't want to put a sunset date after the fees are paid off to clarify things so there aren't dangling participles?
Mr. Chair, there's no reason not to do a sunset. I'm a little hesitant on exactly what that sunset date would be, and the reason for that is in the event there was some sort of refunding that extended the term, we would want to make sure that the corporation existed all the way through whatever term that would be. Probably the better practice here, and I hate to say maybe I need a lifeline, and thankfully Mr. Mitchell is also in the room.
And Mr. Mitchell, you may as well come.
The better practice may be to just wait until this program is all complete, and then we come back to the legislature and repeal it.
Right. To add to that, Mr. Chairman, I previously mentioned the ability to issue the bonds is it fixed in the bill. It expires in the end of 2021. So it would be, if you were going to put some sort of delayed repeal, it would be after something like 10 years after that. There's some precedent. House Bill 111 last year, you may recall, had a delayed repeal for the tax credit sections themselves in 028, more or less 1 year after the last credit was paid off. So it's not a fixed date. It's when a condition is met, and it was in a transitional section, a non-codified section at the end of the bill.
Mr. Mitchell, do you have something to add to that?
Through the chair, Devin Mitchell, Department of Revenue Debt Manager. I really don't. I think those were great answers, and that if there were language that was conditional upon the maturity of all outstanding obligations, that the entity would cease to exist, and that would obviously have to be after 2021 at some point, then I don't think there would be any issues with that.
It's nice not to have to come back and pass another bill to remove something that's no longer effective. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, just clarification on that, Mr. Mitchell. Would the corporation need to remain in existence as long as the bonds are outstanding? Therefore, I mean, right now, I think the model that we have has us paying out until 2031. Obviously, there's different models that could be utilized. Should it exist through the whole period of time and maybe not even a date, but once all are completely paid, or do you feel that it needs to just be after the bonds are issued that the corporation could potentially go away? Because it looks like there might be some interest in sunsetting the actual corporation.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that would be after the final obligations are repaid rather than a date specific for the reasons that Mr. Barnhill pointed out, that we don't really know what the future holds, and you wouldn't necessarily want to limit your flexibility of the future. That said, you could have, I believe, a hard sunset as well that could be, you know, 2035. And I don't know that would impair our ability to market and issue these bonds as well. I don't believe it would.
So just one follow-up.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt.
Just to make sure I understood it. So basically, if we put something that said upon completion of the repayment of the bonds, that would probably be sufficient, whether that's at 2031 or it longer, because maybe we restructure it in you know, 2024 or something like that, something that just gives it that once we have paid all of these off, then it ceases to exist. That probably would be sufficient. Is that kind of what I've understood from what you said?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there further questions at this point? I'm just waiting until the final end here. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So now we're into Title 43, into the tax laws themselves. That Sections 3, 4, and 5 are of a piece with each other. They're in AS 4320. That's actually the corporate income tax statute. And those are the three credits that are outside the traditional system that are also eligible for cash repurchase. 4320046 is the gas storage credit used for the Kenai facility a few years ago. 4320047 is the LNG storage credit that would be used for the interior gas utility. And 4320053 is the refinery credit. So these are fully developed statutes that describe how the credit works and how it's earned and what value it is. And then all of them have a subsection that says these are eligible for repurchase through the state's tax credit repurchase program. Those three sections in sections 3, 4, and 5 are being amended to create an alternative repayment that they're also eligible to purchase via this new mechanism of the bonding fund. And the term of art that you see in the bill is funds dispersed to the commissioner from the Tax Credit Bond Corporation. That basically means the bond sale proceeds, that we could repurchase these with that. And again, it creates a parallel, an alternative payment. Those credits remain able to use the traditional funding mechanism should funds be available, and now they also could be repurchased through the credit buyback in Section 3, 4, and 5. Sections 6 through 9 are amending existing sections of 4355028. That's the tax credit fund and the rules around which the state uses that fund to repurchase state tax credits. So 43028E is in Section 6, and it creates the same alternative flexibility to say we could purchase credits with money in the fund, or the fund could be used as a conduit to use to do the bond repurchase through the bond sales and the money dispersed to the commissioner from the bond corporation. Section 7 is one of the newer sections that amends 028G. This was an amendment done 2 years ago through House Bill 247. 247, you may recall, eliminated the Cook Inlet credits. It also put a cap that said a company can't get more than $70 million per year in cash repurchase. So what we needed to do there was to create an exception to that rule. Mr. Foley earlier said Kalis has $190 million, presuming that he's correct and presuming they participate, they would get substantially more than $70 million at their cash out. The money coming in through the bond program is not susceptible to the $70 million cap. We needed to create a statutory waiver, essentially, or an exception, and that's in Section 7 of the bill. Section 8 is definitions. One of those definitions is money dispersed to the commissioner. That is, I spoke to earlier, that means the bond proceeds and also total interest cost that I spoke to earlier, also the actual interest rate plus the financing and associated costs. So those definitions are in Chapter 8. The last conforming change is Section 9. This is another new section. It amends 028J. It was added by House Bill 247. And what that did was ensure that if a company owes money to the state through another tax or through a royalty or a fine or a fee or some other obligation related to their oil and gas business, that we could offset that with their tax credit payments, that we could back it out without their permission and say, we're going to pay this debt and we'll gross up the difference. We'll pay you the net amount. This is amended to also include that within the tax credit bonding program. So in the case of a company that might stand to get $90 million, if they owe five to the state through something they're delinquent on, we'll pay our own liability to ourselves and give them the remaining 85. And the authority to do that is included within Section 9 of the bill, 028J. So the guts of this bill, Mr. Chairman, are in Section 10. Section 10 adds four new subsections to 028. That talk about how a company would participate in this program. So the first one, 028K, is the mechanism by which a company offers their tax credits to the program. They say they're solicited. They say, we want to participate. What it says is that they must issue all of their credits. You can't pick and choose. You can't cherry pick. And part of that speaks to this idea of gaming we've spoken to, that you don't want a company to say, all right, we're going to sell all of our newer credits in and get the cash now, and then all of our old credits will get bumped up to be first in line so they get better access to the remaining cash, or that they'll be able to participate in a better rate in the second round. So we clarify that you absolutely must commit all of your credits. If you don't participate with credits that you have now, those credits are not available to be purchased through the bonding program in subsequent years. You can't sort of wait out the clock. Obviously, if a company earns new credits between now and the second round, the new credits would be eligible to the second round of financing. We don't want to punish anyone for that, but we do want to make sure that no one takes advantage of the idea that some will be leaving the line and they might bump up. So Section K also includes the idea of timing. They have to make an irrevocable commitment by time certain, that the Commissioner of Revenue comes up with a calculation and says, this is the amount we are going to give you, and that's an offer, and they have to either accept that offer in writing or reject it. And if they've rejected an offer, they've waived their rights to participate in future rounds of funding through the program. So it's a long subsection K. It's technical, but basically that's what it does. It's the mechanism by which a company commits their credits to the bonding program. Subsection L is the mechanism to calculate how much we're going to pay you based on the idea of anticipated prorated amount. So there's three new definitions or quasi-definitions embedded in sub L, and they are assumed payment amount, assumed appropriation, and assumed proration methodology. So in other words, it clarifies first, we're going to pay all the 2016s pro rata among all the companies that hold them. Then we're going to pay all the 17s. And then let's assume, for the sake of calculation, that we are going to make annual appropriations based on the statutory formula. The statutory formula is referenced in L in a way that clarifies any ambiguity in the statute that we spoke to the other day. In other words, it says taxes levied by 011 before the application of any tax credits. So for the purpose of this calculation and this calculation only, we are locking in the 184 in 2019, the 168 in 2020 and beyond, and saying, presuming this stream of appropriations happens, what is any given company's share of that going to be? And then so they'll get $20 million this year, $18 million the next, and $25 the year beyond that, let's just say. And that's in L. And then in M, it says, this is your discount rate. This is how we take that expected cash flow, and how do we gross it up into a single number that we're going to offer as a discounted amount. So what M says that is the discount rate is 10% per year unless you meet one of the four criteria that we've discussed at some length. One is these refinery type credits, the corporate credits, or two, one of the three gives that the company would have to give to the state. You know, for their seismic credits, they would have to give their 10 years of exclusive confidentiality on the data. For certain production, they could give an overriding royalty interest that would be acceptable to the Department of Natural Resources, or this reinvestment requirement. And M sub 3, the reinvestment requirement, is where a lot of our conversation happened the other day. The commissioner is accepting of the 24-month commitment to give, and we've spoken to your staff, Mr. Chairman, about some potential amendments as far as strengthening the authorities in that contingencies, should a company make that commitment and then renege and not make the investments, those sorts of things. All of those sorts of conditions are embedded within subsection M, the discount rate and the application path to get the lower discount rate. Subsection N was one that I didn't expect to see in the bill. I didn't understand it myself at first, but what it says is, if you sell something at less than face value, if you sell your credits and only get, let's say, 85 cents on the dollar, that 15% that you retained has no value. You can't then turn around and keep the amount that was discounted and then try to cash it out, sell it to another person, use it against taxes, that sort of thing. It overtly retires the amount that was discounted from the structure. And that, in a nutshell, is Section 10, the guts of the bill. Section 11 is Department of Natural Resources section, and it talks about the process by which overriding royalty interests are negotiated and accepted. There has to be an offer. That offer has to be valued and risked and discounted, turned into a cash flow, and the fork in the road is where that has to be valued at least the difference between the higher discount rate and the lower discount rate. So in the example we gave in a slide on Saturday, a company would get roughly $85 million at the 10% rate and about $92 million at the 5.1% discount rate. That's a $7 million difference. The overriding royalty interest must be worth at least $7 million to the state for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to be able to sign off on that transaction. And that's all included within Section 11. The rest of the bill are sort of housekeeping sections that always appear at the end of a complex bill. Section 12 authorizes regulations if necessary, also authorizes retroactivity of regulations that we could, if the regulation kicks in because of the process time of that after the effective date of the bill, we can go back to the effective date with those regs. That's in Section 13. And then Section 14, as written, the bill would have an immediate effective date. With the assumption the bill passes in May, that lets us get going right away to start the process of underwriting. It is quite reasonable that this bill could pass without an effective date 2/3 vote. If so, it would be 90 days after it's signed by the governor, which would put us into August or so, still plenty of time to go off the late summer or early fall with the actual selling of the bonds. And that is the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Alper. I've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Go back to Section 6 on page 2. And can you explain once again the interaction with the 028 and the bonds and what that mechanism is for using 028 for the payment or the disbursement of the bonds to basically this entity, and does that at all impact constitutional debt or state debt? If we do that, the money is going to the state, and then the state is doing something with it instead of the bonds coming from the corporation and staying with the corporation.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Seaton, I'll try. I might get a little caught up in some of the details and, again, need to go to the lifeline. But the 028 fund is a fund, and the traditional appropriation passes through that fund, and then without further appropriation, the Department of Revenue staff, approved by the commissioner, has been making these purchases of tax credits for these last 10 or so years. What the language in Section 6 says is the money that comes in through the bonds could also be used to purchase the tax credits. It doesn't actually pass through the 028 fund. In fact, this conforming language, it says, if I'm looking at page 9 of the bill, the department may not purchase, and it adds the words, with money from the oil and gas tax credit fund, more than $70 million in tax credit certificates. So in other words, the traditional appropriations are held to the $70 million. The money that comes through the bond sales are not held to the $70 million. But it creates this the real purpose of Section 6 is just to establish that the old system still exists, but there are certain rules to the old system that don't apply to the bond system. As far as debt capacity, we might need to bring Mr. Mitchell back up here to answer that one.
Okay, that'd be great if you would. Mr. Chairman, can I?
Sure.
And specifically, my question becomes the department, because the department is the one that spends out of 028 funds. So do we get into a situation where it's not the corporation and we get into state debt because the department is buying these instead of I just want to make sure that our legalese and our all the legal stuff that we went through the other day, and now instead of a corporation selling bonds and buying these credits, we have the department doing it if it goes through the 028 fund, as I kind of just generally see it. So that's the question. Has that been investigated? And if not, would you please do that before we come back again?
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Department of Revenue. Let me kick it off just by saying that in the department's view, as well as the Department of Law's view, debt, as it's used in the Alaska Constitution, Article 9, Section 8, has a very specific meaning, term of art, as the Department of Law explained on Saturday, and that means it's the kind of debt in which the state has pledged the full faith and credit of the state. If there's debt issued which does not do that, then it's not debt governed by the Alaska Constitution, plain and simple. There's nothing in this bill that pledges the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska, and therefore it's not debt that's governed by the Alaska Constitution. So the issue about whether there's revenue or anything in this bill that potentially triggers the Alaska Constitution's definition of debt, our view is it just doesn't do that. It doesn't go there, and it doesn't go there because it doesn't anywhere pledge the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska. In fact, it disclaims that in Section 2 of this bill, that the full faith and credit is not pledged. Therefore, it's not state constitutional debt. That perspective is held quite strongly by the Department of Law as well as bond counsel. And in fact, many, many, many issuances using a variety of structures relies on that interpretation. And so it's, quite frankly, the anxiety that was expressed and discussed at great length on Saturday is just never one that we've really contemplated would be at issue in this, but we remain quite comfortable that the constitutional issues simply are not triggered by this bill. Happy to have Mr. Mitchell weigh in further.
So Devin Mitchell again. And as we discussed on Saturday, I don't think we actually did go into maybe what we were contemplating for formulating the commitment to pay between the corporation and the state. So as Mr. Alper pointed out, the statutes were modeled off the Pension Obligation Bond Corporation, and we obviously went quite a ways down the path towards issuing those obligations, and so contemplated quite a bit how that commitment to pay would be created. And what was determined was there would be a funding agreement. So that in that instance, it would be the Department of Administration would enter into a funding agreement with the corporation, and so there would be a one-time deposit into the pension trusts from the corporation's sale of bonds. In exchange for that, there's a commitment to pay from the state through the Department of Administration for purposes of satisfying the annual debt service of the corporation, and that appropriation, of course, would be subject to appropriation of the legislature every year. And that was the model that we were anticipating if this legislation is approved, using for this public corporation as well. So there would be a funding agreement that the corporation would enter into with the Department of Revenue. And in some ways, that's why optically and practically some of the concerns that you were discussing, having the public corporation an arm's length legal existence from the Department of Revenue, helps in that effort, that the Department of Revenue will enter into this funding agreement, contractual commitment with the corporation. The corporation will provide a one-time funding each time there's a transaction, and in exchange for that, receive a commitment from the department to seek an annual appropriation for the funding agreement payment amounts, which would be the annual debt service related to the bond issuance and perhaps the annual $2,500 for paying agent services, which is just an ongoing contractual thing that you have with every bond issuance.
Thank you, and I just want to make sure that we cover all the bases, and if we transfer this money into the existing 028 fund, whether that can make any complications. So as long as you guys look at that, that's great. The other thing on bonds was, when you go to sell bonds, is there sometimes an amount that gives you a better rate? And in other words, if you go to sell bonds and you have buyers that'll go up to $500 million, but they don't want to buy $1 billion or $900 million, is that something that happens, or is it the other way? The bigger the issue, the lower the rate.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, it's an interesting question because there are different buyers that participate in different sized transactions. Specific to taxable transactions, bigger is definitely better. That there are investors that look for $50 million block size, meaning they want $50 million for themselves and they want other people to have $50 million blocks so that there's a high probability of secondary market liquidity, meaning that they're going to be able to trade that paper later on in the event of their needing to get out of the position. The municipal market's a little bit different. It doesn't have some of the same thresholds that the taxable market has. Certainly to get the market's attention, it does help to have size, but size would be smaller, not billions, but hundreds of millions. If you have a $100 million transaction, you can definitely get sufficient attention of the market versus like a $5 million transaction, which you're going to get more of a different class of buyers. You're not going to get the same sorts of institutional investors that would look at a larger transaction. So if we're going to be selling, and we don't know exactly what we're going to be selling on a taxable tax exempt basis because it requires additional tax work, but if we have an $800 million transaction that went, for example, 50-50 or 60-40, either one of those scenarios would be, I think, certainly on the tax exempt side, very a highlighted municipal market issuance, and especially now when there's been, due to tax law changes, people can't do advance refundings anymore in the municipal market. And so that change in the ability to refinance bonds has diminished supply. And so a $400 or $500 million issuance coming out of an issuer is going to get a lot of attention right now. On the taxable side, I think while it might not be billions, I still think it's of a sufficient size that we'd get good market interest in the transaction.
Okay, I just want revenue and you guys to look at that in Section 7, where we're getting rid of the $70 million cap, and that just depends on the size of the bond. If you anticipate that you're going to be able to sell all the bonds without any interest differences between those, that's fine. Otherwise, we might have to consider some kind of pro rata amounts if the bond issuance is lower than what people are willing to come to. So I just want to make sure that we're asking all the questions that are appropriate on each one of these sections and make sure, I'm sure you folks have thought of almost all these things, but.
And Mr. Co-Chair, as far as, I know we had a discussion about how it would work with deposit into the fund, and with many transactions, we'll often fund money into an escrow account where it would be a requisition process for obtaining money out of that fund for qualified expenditures. And so that would have been the type of structure that we used for Goose Creek, for example, where as the project was conducted and it was built by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, there would be a requisition from the borough to the construction fund with sign-off from the state bond committee for purposes of paying contractors. And so we could, if there was going to be an issue with money being deposited directly into the fund, consider a structure like that as well.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So maybe I missed it, but is a specific payment plan in the bill, the one that you showed on Saturday?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, just to make sure I understand the question, the idea of the 2 years of interest only and the rate rising principal, that is not defined in the bill. What is in the bill through the chair is just that the corporation has the authority to establish those terms, and obviously the market will help establish those terms too. The people buying the bonds might prefer things in a certain way. It is our intent to go forth in the way that we modeled it and presented it on Saturday, but there's no requirement to do it exactly that way.
A follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what would happen if it's higher than that? I mean, so once, if we pass this bill, then basically, except it's upon appropriation, I understand that, but the agreement you go in with those you sell the bonds to could possibly be higher than what you showed on Saturday, correct?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, if the interest rate is higher than we're showing, then the discount rate that we'll be buying the bonds at will also, buying the credits at will also be higher, meaning we'll be buying it for a little bit less money to cover the fact that it's larger interest. The lower discount rate for the companies that are participating in that isn't set until the very last minute, when we already pretty much know what our interest rate's going to be. If the question is, are we restructuring the timing of the payment? If we're going to have to do a flat amortization over 10 years, let's just say, that'll change the timing of the payments. It'll increase the amount we'd have to pay in the first couple of years. But the net effect, we've modeled it in all different ways, is still advantageous to the state. It's just slightly different numbers. But yes, we would, in that the bill is attached to a fiscal note right now that requests $27 million with the assumption that that's what our FY19 interest obligation would be. If the bonds ended up being sold under different terms, we would have to come back looking for a supplemental at that point.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
I guess he didn't read the operating budget that we're not doing supplementals or trying not to. But I guess my concern is somewhat what Representative Seat was kind of getting to on different terms for different companies depending upon what that first batch looked like and whether the interest went up. But I'm more concerned kind of the, you know, as we're still dealing with the PERS and TERS issue, and now you have another bonding issue. The first couple of years seems like it's pretty low because we're only doing the interest portion, but then we're looking at over $100 million at that time. If we're looking at PERS and TERS possibly doubling or having some of those costs as well, and oil doesn't go up, then how do we manage that? So that's just a concern. But I have one other question for the commissioner now that he's back.
Wilson.
Thank you for being back. So we had a little discussion when you were gone, and so one of the questions I had asked one of the companies, they have development plans now. They always change depending upon how much money they can invest. But the question was whether or not they would be required to put new development plans to meet their obligation for the, you know, 2 years of showing that they're going to do more investment in Alaska, or could they possibly utilize what they already have in place with DNR?
That's a great question. I've got to say I haven't I hadn't contemplated their existing development plan. So let us look at the statute and look at that, and let us get back to you the next time. I'm not certain. My expectation was that this would be an overall amount that they were investing, but let me kind of reflect on that and come back to you.
I'd appreciate that. We don't want to make things more difficult. Again, they met their obligations. This is something we've decided to add, like we're giving them some kind of reward when that's not the way it is. But, and I guess the reason I want to know also is because those plans may have incorporated other items, because we had heard from at least one company that they had planned on doing more development, but because of these credits, they didn't have the amount of money to be able to go forward, but yet they may already have it all on paper, and I just don't want to see a repeat of what they have.
Thank you. Through the chair, I also want to respond to your question about the PERS and TERS. And the second to last slide in the material we showed on Saturday did show that even when you add the PERS and TERS to this new schedule, we are flattening out the total amount of the payment as a percentage of state UGF. So I think there's a benefit. You're right. PERS and TERS is rising. This will be rising in those out years, but it's still not going to peak at the same high level that it would if we didn't do this program.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
If I remember correctly, and I'll go back to the slides, it was also dependent upon oil going up more than what it is now. I think that was what I remember, that we were contemplating that we wouldn't be at these prices at that time and therefore might be able to more easily meet. And I don't think I want a better budget anymore on the price of oil.
Through the chair, that's a fair statement. In other words, we believe pushing these payments out is an appropriate strategy because we do anticipate an improvement in the state budget. But even if it's not, I think what that slide will show you is that as a percentage of UGF, and the UGF in those scenarios is all static, so they're all consistent. Under the status quo, if we don't enact this, it caps out at about 31%, the combination of debt and PERS and TERS plus these credits. And with this program, it caps out about 24%. So my point is just that this program will provide a smoother, flatter overall expense to the state, regardless of what happens with oil.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, I'd like to go back to a little bit more broader perspective on why we may or may not want to enter into or pass HB 331. Mr. Mitchell, last Saturday through the phone, I asked you a question about if we go down the path of engaging in HB 331 and go into the bond program to take care of these credits, would that have a potential impact on our ability to bond for things like infrastructure spending, which is a priority and a responsibility that, you know, that the state has in terms of protecting our investments and protecting our infrastructure. It also would have the benefit of creating jobs, just like HB 331 would. My question is then, could you further elaborate on what the potential impact might be on the state's ability to engage in a bond program for infrastructure and things like that if we were to go down 330, the road of 331?
Through the chair again, this is Devin Mitchell. So we talked about, or I talked about this on Saturday after your question a couple of times, and I think my discussion was that there are pros and cons around this from just a strictly debt management perspective, that we have a liability that we're refinancing, and so it's not as impactful as a new obligation, but it does take what we would classify as a soft liability and make it a hard liability, meaning there is no optionality in payment at that point from, again, my perspective. And therefore, it does, based on our and combined with our experience with POBs, it does have an impact on rating agencies' consideration of the state's debt capacity, because it's going to be included in net tax supported debt. So I think I said it would have not a full $800 million worth of impact on our capacity, but something like a quarter of that, like $200 million.
and that in the debt affordability analysis that was released earlier this year, that we opined that the current debt capacity of the state, given the metrics that we follow and the current unrestricted general fund revenue forecast from the fall, was in the $300 to $400 million range. And so there are a lot of other variables, obviously, that are in play, but given that fact set, it would, without considering those other matters, would say that it does have an impact on our current ability to borrow.
Representative Ortiz.
Follow up. Then, thank you. So is it safe to say that, you know, while, you know, maybe 10 years ago the state did a better job, certainly was more able to be all things to all people, not completely, but certainly more than we are now, if we go down this road, is it safe to say that, in effect, we are limiting choices in the future, limiting options in the future for future administrations, for future legislatures, and limiting their ability to address these issues that aren't going to go away? In other words, we do have foregone maintenance issues that are starting to pile up. We do have real needs to answer our, school repairs throughout the state, things like that. And that's going to limit our ability. If we go down this road, it's going to limit our ability to answer those questions and reduce our options in our ability to answer those questions.
Through the
or come up with solutions for those problems. Yeah.
I think it does. It both limits, but it also broadens. I mean, as Commissioner Fisher pointed out, you have a budgetary smoothing that's the result of this proposal that does allow some flexibility. If the state had, in an ideal world, the state would have a capital project plan that was embedded with a debt management component, and you had highly essential projects that were funded on a routine and regular basis using a policy that flowed from one group of elected officials to the next, but it's been much more ad hoc than that. And so it's a challenge, but I don't know that there's, a right. This is using a tool for a purpose, and every action has a reaction.
Thank you.
Representative Gutten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out again, because it was brought up here briefly, that Lynch Legal gave us a 7-page opinion on the constitutionality, and we just got a press release from the Attorney General. There is another document here from the Commissioner, but I certainly was looking forward for a broader basis to have the conversation back and forth on. I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Magano, I know that you have an answer to this. Maybe it's something that has you'd follow up with. But in response, or just following up on Representative Ortiz's question on what impact passing this bill would have on our bonding capacity, do you have an amount? If we wanted to do a bond for capital projects, do you have a – if we pass this bill, can we know what kind of capital project bond we could pass? I mean, do you have numbers that – when you talk about it would impact – it could impact our ability to bond? Would you be able to let us know what kind of bond we could issue?
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Fisher. Can I ask, for when he answers that question, do you want him to assume whether there's the POMB has passed or not passed?
I guess both ways, since we don't know, right?
I think that may be fair, although I guess my assumption, maybe this is unfair, is that the notion of the capital budget was premised on the assumption that there would be a POMV that would fund it. But maybe that's not a fair assumption on our part. But we can, that's fine. We can talk about it both ways. But obviously, if the POMV passes, then that question, as Mr. Mitchell has said, is a much simpler answer.
And for a little better explanation of that, the idea is that if percent of market value passes, then there is an expectation that that the earnings reserve is available in some form and some amount for state spending and supporting state services. So that there's a difference as whether that is an asset that's counted or not counted as far as in a bondable amount. Is that, I mean, we're off in never land here, and I just want to get it a little clearer as to why it makes a difference whether a percent of market value passed or did not pass.
Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Fisher again. Yes, I think that, and I'll let Mr. Mitchell answer, but with the percent of market value and that being enacted and there being the expectation that you now have a statutory basis for that amount being part of the general fund on a going forward basis, then there will be a much larger amount of bonding capacity that's available versus if it's not.
Okay, thank you.
So through the chair, Representative Garrett, so the like I stated a moment ago, the debt affordability analysis that we released in January used the fall forecast, and our historical metrics for purposes of determining debt capacity are that we want general obligation debt and what we call state supported debt to be no more than 5% of unrestricted general fund revenue. And you throw the school debt reimbursement program on top of that, and we don't want it to be more than 8%. We haven't really been incorporating we've been noting it, but not really incorporating the obligations that the state has placed upon itself through the payment on behalf of the employer situation with PERS and TERS, where you hold the employers harmless at percentage of payroll levels, not making them pay the actuarially determined payroll levels. And with that analysis, our projected unrestricted general fund revenue, which is about 2.3-ish billion, churned out, and our existing debt, which is declining. We have a mature program, and so we generally have stair-stepping down obligations. We have some new obligations yet to issue that are already authorized, but a 10-year look forward resulted in a debt capacity in the $300 to $400 million range, meaning that over the next 10 years you would be highly confident of maintaining credit rating with a debt issuance program of that amount. So this has a significant impact on a percentage basis on a number like that. It's like if my guesstimation of $200 million of impact is accurate, then that's half of that what's obviously a fairly limited capacity. Now let's say that there is a POMV that passes, and the number that's been kind of batted about is maybe there would be $1.7 billion that would, on an annualized basis, and then growing with inflation at 2.25%, would be available for unrestricted general fund spending. So what does that do? Well, that's going to make those ratios look a lot better. And he doesn't look very big, Commissioner Fisher, but he beat me up on this pretty good. Because in my view, it can't just be the same analysis that we used in the past, because we're kind of taking out that big shiny tool we had in the toolbox and never used and incorporating it into our plan. And so we really need to have a holistic review of that debt affordability analysis. And so I've been hesitant to really go to the high end of that historical analysis. But at the low end, which I'm comfortable with, it would increase our debt capacity, what was it, by about it would bring that $300 or $400 million of capacity up to about $1.7 billion.
Reverend Guerra.
Yeah. So it's to be close to $1.7 billion with the passage of this bill too.
And so then if you said this bill had a $200 million theoretical impact, it would be then a remaining capacity of $1.5 billion.
Thanks.
And that again is that kind of the low end based on my reluctance to want to use those historical metrics without consideration of some of these really shifts that have occurred since we started doing the debt affordability analysis with the payments on behalf of the employers and that becoming a harder liability for the state from a credit rating perspective, and it being included in our CAFR and the impacts of that. So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pruitt?
No, actually, I'm good.
I had a question on page 3 under section 10. We're on the 028M, and we're looking at number 1. We've talked about these, but let's say for a seismic credit under number 1. And, you know, we're talking in general terms, but let's say we have two different companies that are willing to release their seismic right away. And one of them was in early stage of development and is going to be a long ways. I mean, they shot seismic 2 years ago and the other guy shot seismic 8 years ago. So how do you value the release of seismic data early on these projects and get to a 5% discount change when one has almost, by the time it gets released and everything, has almost no influence on anything because it's going to be released in 10 years, and the other one is a significant potential shift?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an important question because it helps clarify this issue of what we're talking about with these seismic credits and what data would be given. There are certain credits that were earned for seismic work itself that are still outstanding and unpaid. You heard that from Mr. Hastings when he testified before. Those credits are for work that was all done in the last couple of years. If there was seismic shooting done 6 or 8 years ago, and there were credits associated with that, they were long paid, and those aren't the credits that isn't the seismic data that's being considered for early release. It's the seismic data that's specific to the credit shoots that have the open tax credits against them. So it's a much more recent vintage of tax credits. And if we had a case, and this was a question that I got asked in a previous committee, where let's say you have a company that has some seismic credits as well as some other credits because maybe they drilled an exploration well in the aftermath of their credits, it's only the seismic credit that would be bought down to the better discount rate. They would not be able to get all of their non-seismic credits at the better discount rate simply for giving the data for their seismic credits. Does that help with the question?
That does help. I mean, we just haven't had a good explanation of how we get two rates and such variable conditions of terms and all. It's going to be either A or B. And so what you're telling us now is that there may be, although you've done the analysis on 5.1%, it may be that 10% of a company's credit is 5.1 and the rest is at 10. And another company may have its work commitments maybe on part of its creditable amount. And so that might get 5.1, but the 5.1 won't go to the other pad or the other well infrastructure, and so that may still be at 10. So is that the way this works? Otherwise, it's not just an on-off lever 10 or 5.1?
So, Mr. Chairman, the seismic credits are discrete. There's a finite amount of them within the set, maybe let's call it 10% of the total credits outstanding, 10-15% are seismic. I could imagine a split application where a company might have that and then not be able to obtain the better discount rate on a non-seismic credit. As far as the reinvestment requirement, the way we interpret it, that one would not be splittable. They would need to make a commitment in the full amount of their cash out that the company would be getting, whether that's $10 million or $200 million. They would need to commit the full amount of their payment within that 24-month period, is how I interpret it the way it's written. Obviously, we'd have to look at specific applications coming in, but I don't see someone trying to split that particular provision.
Okay, and the overriding royalty, someone has credits that are on, you know, several different operations, more than one well, different places and all. So is the overriding royalty on each part of the company's production or based on the credit? Let's say they had production or they had operations in one portion of the North Slope and they have some creditable base on others. Does that mean the overriding royalty is on the entire company production? The overriding royalty on that for which the credits were generated, how do we get to that? Is that proportional also, or is that company-wide?
So, Mr. Chairman, the overriding royalty section is not explicit to the leases where there might have been credits earned. The only requirement is that the company has tax credits eligible for repurchase, and then they're negotiating an overriding royalty. They would be negotiating with DNR for a royalty on perhaps an associated lease. It could even be on another lease that they have under production that, if anything, if they have a lease under current production, that might be perceived as more valuable to DNR because there's much less risk associated with it. But there's not a requirement that all of their leases be included within that or even the ones that had the credits on them be associated, just that they're offering something of value to the state. And that the commissioner of DNR would have to value that in such a way that it would be worth the incremental money.
And that's the net present value of the incremental amount, and that would be based on the plan of development of when they are estimating production and at what level starting.
So, Mr. Chairman, yes, there would be the expectation of the plan of development when they say they're going to come online, and then there would be a certain risking that goes on, which is not unlike what we, along with DNR, do in doing the production forecast, to say that they might say this, but maybe there's only a 60% chance it's going to happen this year and another chance that it might bump into a future year. So that level of uncertainty gets baked into the calculation, more or less reducing the value of what they're saying their cash flow would be, and then there'd be a present value assigned to it. And then the result of that calculation, the discounted risk present value, would have to be greater than the increment between the higher discount rate and the lower discount rate, the so-called $7 million, the difference between giving them the 85 and the 92. That calculation would result in something perceived to be worth at least $7 million to the state.
Yeah, I think it's good to get out a little more explanation of how you're trying to develop this cost benefit to the state, and I think that that's been helpful to me because it really hasn't been explained yet how that value chain is established in the different 1 through 4. So other questions? Not seeing any. Then thank you very much. And is there any wrap-up that you need to give or any explanation for anything we've asked that didn't fully have a chance to answer?
Mr. Chairman, I took some notes of questions that were asked and things that came up during testimony. I could speak for a couple of minutes now if you like. We could also write a letter and submit it to the committee.
Why don't you write a letter?
Okay.
Not that we don't want to hear you, but I think that our memories will be better jogged by having it in writing. And we appreciate everybody's participation today. And I am going to not having find out when we'll recess to. Our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, the 24th. That's tomorrow at 1:30, where we'll take a public testimony on House Bill 331 and address further questions from members. And Representative Wilson has a question.
Mr. Chairman, is there any anticipation on amendment deadline? Because it hasn't been discussed.
Currently, let's see, we're going to set 331 aside, and I'd like the committee to know that amendments are due to Jane Pearson by 5 o'clock Wednesday the 25th.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So is there anything else to come before the committee? We will be recessed then at 4:15.